Welcome to Design Me a House. I'm architect designer Katie Hutchison, and with me is
Dawn Oliveira, textile designer and educator.
Today, in Season 2, Episode 9, we are doing a shop talk episode. And what we thought we would do is delve into just one part of the design process, you know, at length, you know, at least for an episode, because what we've done before was the overview introduction of what the design process is,
right?
You know, from beginning to end. And the fun part, and one of the most critical parts, is in the beginning.
So the beginning, yeah. Concept phase.
Yeah, so for Dawn, I think she calls it concept. For us, in the architecture world, it's often schematic design and or concept. Mm-hmm. So Dawn, let's have you,
Want me to start?
Start, if you could.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about, I mean, I've seen some of, just from when we've done actually the previous episode, some of your kind of early, I don't know if I would call them sketches, but drawings.
Yes.
But like, how do you first start? Like,
you know what?
Happens?
Let me start with, if I'm designing, this is how we do it in textiles. You design a collection. Okay.
Okay.
So you think your concept should be related to a collection of designs. And you do that because you want to sell the collection, not just one design, right? So you think about the theme of that collection.
So you are talking right now, not when you have an individual client who's come to you and says, I want this custom thing. This is for yourself. This is for your brand.
Okay. You want me to clarify that?
Sure.
Okay. So when you're designing a collection, I'm talking about designing a collection for my line. It's not for custom work. It's not for a specific client. It's for my line of printed fabrics.
Okay.
And I can refer back to the very first collection I did called Ocean Collection, where I started out doing research on underwater imagery, mm-hmm. underwater photographs, choosing, you know, certain sea life that I thought could be really cool in how I would illustrate them, how I would redraw them, how I would simplify them and turn mm-hmm. them into pattern.
Okay.
And I do that with every time I start a new collection. That's what I do. So for this next collection that I'm designing that I'd like to finish one day, it's about flora. And I always am drawn to exotic flora, like really weird looking flowers that look like they might come from another planet.
Neat.
And then I start doing the same thing. I start redrawing those shapes and think about, how many colors am I going to use? How simplified are the shapes going to be? How big are the shapes going to be? What kind of repeat will those shapes fit into to become a pattern that can be printed continuously?
Can I interject? How often do you do a new collection?
Not that often, because once a group is done, once a collection is done, then I continually spend time coming up with colorways for those mm-hmm. new prints. Mm-hmm. And what eventually happens is clients see the new group of designs and they go, well, I love that anemone pattern, say, but I want it in purple instead of blue.
Yes.
And then I start doing all this custom work with that.
Based on the
designs.
Original. So how many collections do you currently have?
I mainly have one big collection, but it's really broken up into two because I have the sea-inspired patterns. Mm-hmm. And then I have like my Madeira vine and my Lisbon trellis that are more floral based, floral geometric based.
Okay.
In fact, you recently saw one of the prints called Gator, which is purely geometric.
I love, you know, listeners, go to Dawn's website.
Oh,
I actually am getting Gator on some new pillows from Dawn.
It work
and
in a lime.
What's cool about it to me is it's abstract enough, that pattern.
Yeah.
That you don't, like, you calling it Gator makes sense to me when I see it. But if you didn't know that was the name of it ahead of time.
Yeah, it just looks like
just
a really
really
cool
neat. Yeah,
pattern.
And it has, it's a 2D pattern, obviously, but it has three-dimensionality, I think.
Yeah, that, see, you picked that up because you're an architect. And it's just, I really love that pattern because I do love geometric designs. I just started out doing these more flora or sea-inspired shapes, but I want to continue to introduce geometric pattern mainly because it really does suit a larger audience.
That's what I was going to say. It's very
not just
versatile.
Women are going to go for these floral patterns, which happens often.
But also when you wanted to, if you want to use several patterns together, I find that introducing a geometric is a
good
way to do that.
Good point. When you're designing, when I'm designing a collection, the scale of the patterns have to work together, meaning some should be large, some mm-hmm. smaller, some simpler, some more detailed, and some geometric, and some not.
Right.
So that you can literally, with color, create this cohesive group of patterns yeah. that look fabulous together yeah. in a room.
Because in the case of what I have at my house from you, Dawn, is the Madeira vine. I'm going to say floral.
Yeah, I just reprinted
but,
that. Yeah. Yes.
But it's got a lot of kind of movement and curve to it.
It does. And, but it's a stripe as well.
Yeah. And so then I think working in these new pillows we're going to be adding with the gator, I like the contrast.
Oh, I'm so glad you're doing that.
But I think it's going to also relate. So it will both.
Yes.
Both of those
That's
things.
That's how you
once.
Do it with color.
Right.
But you can put the most disparate designs together in terms of style, shape,
right,
whatever.
Right.
But if the colors all work together,
right.
not to sound like I want to create granimals, you know, like those kids' clothes that everything was like so dumbed down in terms of color.
No.
I don't do that. But they do have to relate.
Well, and also the pattern that I have of yours, Madeira, there's what would you describe? I know lime is the green. What would you call the other colors in that pattern?
It's like a coffee color.
Yeah.
It's like a coffee brown. It's not brown, but it's
a little bit
like
rose.
A yellower brown.
Yeah.
So it works well with the lime.
Yeah. So she's, for me, Dawn is picking up in my pillows the green from the Madeira vine in the gator pattern, the lime green.
And yeah, it's going to be fun.
It's going to be absolutely lovely. So we got sidetracked there, but I was interested also, the reason I bring this up is this new pattern collection, the Flora collection.
Flora.
Yeah. Do you imagine, I mean, it sounds to me like a natural that it's going to relate to your previous collections. Is that part of your goal?
That's what my goal is, okay. But I tend to get carried away with detail. Like I have to really hold back on the detail just because I spent so many years designing complex patterns for other companies.
Yeah.
But like one of the flora I'm working on now is the passion flower, and it's like, I started out doing it with way too much detail. So now I'm simplifying back down to 2 to 3 colors so that it does relate back to the original group, the original collection. I want everything to work together.
Okay. So someone could pick from either collection, perhaps.
Right. Okay. Right. And that's my goal.
Okay.
It sounds so simple, but, you know, as an artist, as a designer, it takes some focus.
Oh, completely.
Just continually keep everything working sort of together.
Yeah.
But I will say that, remember when we did the Instagram, our favorite Instagrams?
Yes.
The company that I love so much, Votsa, I have to say their patterns are all over the crazy place.
Right.
And yet they're so phenomenally well executed and beautifully painted that you could put the most wild patterns together somehow. They're unique. Each one is unique.
Right.
But anyway, I love what they do. And I am hoping that a lot of my patterns will stand on their own as well. Mm-hmm. Because I do sell them individually. People say, I want that Madeira vine, for instance. But I really would love it in a blue and green instead of a coffee and lime.
Right.
So I spend a lot of time doing that.
These are specifically related to design schematic concepts for these collections of yours. What about when a client comes to you? Because I know you do other work as well, where you'll have a client who is looking for services. How do you start in that case for a concept?
Thank you for that question. Well, it depends on what the client is looking for. Like I also work with fashion people, fashion companies, and very often they want something nothing like what my original collection is like. It's you know, they've already got a design in mind, or they own a piece of vintage fabric.
Oh, okay.
Want me to duplicate it or do a riff on it. And so I spend a lot of time doing that kind of work as well. It's pretty labor intensive, but I've done it for years and years and years. So those particular clients, I'm designing something very custom just for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have the clients that come in and do like my original collection, but want to do 2 or 3 of them in their own custom colors that work with their house, work with their living room.
But so in the case where it's someone who's, you know, whether it's a fashion client or whatever, someone who's, it's not self-generated from one of your collections, they're giving you enough from the get-go that's probably a different way of working in terms of concept.
Different way of working. Okay. And sometimes it's a lot of information. Just duplicate this vintage piece from 1800.
Right.
We really want to do it in more updated colors
yep.
and make the scale a little bit bigger.
Yep.
So I can do that. And sometimes it's very little information. It's just, you know, like one client gave me a piece of an old wallpaper.
Yep.
That was this huge kind of Polish painted vine thing. It was crazy. And just said, I want to do something on a smaller scale, but for fashion, for a dress.
Neat.
And so I came up with something and it's done really well for her. So that was fun. Cool. I like when I have the freedom to do whatever the heck I want. Let's face it.
Your own collection. Yeah.
Yeah. Or even for another client, they just say, do this, you know, create something wonderful for me. Here's a start.
Just and they trust you to just do it. Yeah.
They trust me to just do it. Yeah. I mean,
they've chosen you
years,
for a reason. They've seen your work and they're like,
gotcha.
We think Dawn can do it.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's
now,
so fun.
Yeah. That's it. So let's compare to how you start.
Well, I think the primary difference is I have clients, right? So that's why I was kind of wanted to talk about the difference between coming up with your own collection, but all my work is client-based. And I agree with some of the later comments you made about when you do have client-based work, the more enjoyable client-based work is when you're allowed to exercise your design skills.
There's trust.
Right. And when they want you to work up a design for them, as opposed to someone who is looking, what I often say, if I get a sense that someone is looking almost for drafting services, in that they have made up their mind to such a degree about what it is that they want, that they're almost looking for someone to just execute their vision, which to me is not what you hire an architect for. You know, for me, that's okay. We'll go work with a draftsperson or a builder. But you really come to an architect because you're looking for their design expertise. So the client who's going to be open to where the design might go, obviously giving you as much information as they can about their parameters,
right,
what they're interested in, but not being prescriptive about it, that I need it to look like this. It's kind of like, well...
So then, do you take on those kinds of jobs?
No,
really?
I try to defer them. But
you don't
always know. You might think something is one thing and it turns out to be another. So that's kind of the tricky part.
It is tricky because you don't want to spin your wheels.
Well,
exactly.
And you want it to be, you know, you want both the designer and the client homeowner to feel like it's a productive collaboration.
Very good.
You kind of don't want one person oversteering. So you also don't want the architect like telling the client, you know, how to live in their house, right? You don't want it, you know, to pendulum swing that too far.
That's really tricky.
Right. So it is a collaboration and it's you need a dynamic where, you know, that you're working together, you know, the homeowner and the designer architect, and you're both improving the design because of your collaboration.
Right. And I have to say at this point, I've seen enough of your work, and obviously you can see your work on your website, Katie Hutchison Studio, that if I were to hire you to do a kitchen reno or an entire house reno, in looking at that, the work you've done, there's a certain level of expertise and attention to detail that you trust. So
that's what you would hope. Yeah.
You would hope.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
I go, wow, this architect really knows what she's doing. And I think she could give us a great, wonderful reno. Let's just give her a, you know, kind of a rundown, point.
Well, it's interesting. The,
let her go.
Before we started recording, you and I were just talking about a project that I recently completed. Because I've been putting it on Instagram. So you saw some of the pictures of it.
It's gorgeous.
And it's a very fun project. But the reason I bring that one up is that client was wonderful to work with. And when I first started, when I first met him, he was purchasing the house. And this particular house is in a really wonderful location right on the water in Riverside, Rhode Island. It's very high above the water. So luckily he doesn't have some of the floodplain issues that waterfront people can have.
Nice.
But it was just a little cottage. It was super modest. But he saw the potential in it, the building and the location. So he knew he wanted to buy it. And he was living in Providence at the time. But he didn't know exactly what he wanted to do with it. And what was great about him is when he brought me in the first time, you know, sometimes people have thought through to a certain degree their goals. So they're going to say, oh, I want a master bedroom suite, or I want to, you know, change the kitchen because you can see it's so dated or whatever. But they'll have right. like a list of what their issues are. He was kind of like, he was much more open, which is where I'm going with this. What I liked about it is he's like, what do you think is the potential here?
Oh, nice.
You know, what are some things I might want to do with this house? So it was much more.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it was
that's
wonderful.
A great opening.
It was
yeah.
much more open. So,
yeah.
You know, if we walked through, and of course, with any project, there's a lot you can do. And of course, there's always budget, right?
Yeah.
But his thinking was, you know, like, what are like either two or three different possible scenarios I could pursue that go up in complexity and expense, you know? So kind of what's a modest thing I could do? What's something that's a little bit more involved, and what might be, you know, the most.
So you have to give him those choices.
Well, you know, this is just, you know, I've just shown up and opened the door and walked in. So this is kind
yes.
of, he's not saying, tell me exactly right now. And
right.
It's
right.
more like, this is what I want to get a sense of. And so we walk through and you can see, you know, right away, you know, where there's some potential, where there's, you know, some really some issues, some problems.
Okay.
And so I wrote him a proposal that was basically like an a la carte design list. So, you know, here are a bunch of things you could do, you know, and these are just me verbally describing because I have not yet been retained, right? I haven't
right.
done the design process.
Right.
I'm simply, it's the very beginning. And so that's when, I guess my point of making this comment is it's really in the beginning when you want to be most open to where a project could go. And you don't want to start shutting down the doors of options.
You as the architect don't want to start.
No, homeowner.
Or the client.
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. Like a homeowner, both. I think, is really missing out if they decide too quickly what it is that they want to do. I don't mean necessarily how
right.
it looks, but what's
right.
the scope of the project? And so you might think, well, I really feel like you, meaning a potential client homeowner, might be like, well, I feel like I want this new master suite over here or whatever. And it might turn out that, you know, maybe we could change the use of some of the rooms that exist.
Yes.
And give you a master suite. But because we will be making these changes wherever they are, it means that, in fact, we could really improve your kitchen access.
And that's
to the outdoor
why they hire
and,
you.
Hey,
because
right,
they
so
don't
the
have
idea.
The vision to think that way.
Yeah,
knock
like
this wall down, turn it into this kind of room.
Yeah.
Work.
So just being kind of open
yeah.
to like, what's the, I loved his question. Like, what's the potential here? You know, because when you have a kind of an open boundary like that, you can come up with some interesting ideas. Now, some of the things, like the more extreme or more dramatic ideas that we were talking about, we didn't end up pursuing. You know, they were complicated
okay.
in terms of permitting. They were complicated in terms
the
of
cost.
Expense.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
we really did what often happens is you end up coming in kind of more reasonably, if you will, in the middle.
Yeah.
So you're
okay.
like, well, I don't want to only do the kitchen when I could take advantage of all these other wonderful things. But I also, like we were going to kind of bridge across an opening that exists between his house and his garage.
There's yeah,
a wonderful
I saw
opening
that
to the water.
Exterior work that
yeah,
you did.
So there's a beautiful
wow.
captured water view there. And we thought it would be
yeah.
kind of fun. We were actually thinking of building on the second floor over that view corridor and connecting uh-huh. to the garage and putting living space above the garage.
Wow.
So that would have been a much bigger project, and it was going to have some pretty complicated permitting.
Okay.
So, you know, this is one of the ones I think I've mentioned before where we ended up, we go through several schemes and I give them letters usually, scheme A, B, C, D.
Uh-huh.
And that project ended up at scheme G, just to give you a sense. Yeah. So, you know, you go along and
that's
it evolves.
Yeah. You said this was a 2-year project.
Yeah. So that, and the reason.
That's the difference between how we work. Yours
yes.
go on and on.
And the reason that, and the John and I had this conversation before we started recording, the reason why that project has that time frame is any project that has complicated permitting, like this one did, because it's on the waterfront,
right.
That's really where you can take up some time. Okay. So you have to go through these permitting hurdles, and you don't want to advance the design in advance of approval because it could be a waste of time and money.
Time and money, sure.
So you want to know that your project is approved before you, you know, create construction drawings for it. Okay. And then in this case, this project also began during the pandemic, really. So the pandemic really threw the timing of this project off.
Okay.
So even once we were able to start, also there were some crew members who got COVID, and once we did start, there was the huge delay in the steel order. We needed steel because there's a cantilever deck on that project.
Oh my goodness.
And the steel just wasn't available. And we needed the steel to advance the rest of the structural improvements that we were going to do. So that was a real big hiccup. In terms of timing. So it ended up, you know, this one was unusually long time frame, but the reason I had mentioned it earlier is it is a good thing for clients, homeowners to be aware of that if your project is on the water or in or near conservation land, or, you know, has some type of potentially complicated permitting, you need to appreciate that this project's going to take some time, you know, from when you first begin to when you, you know, you have the keys and you no longer have people like myself and the other subs showing up and calling
and
your project the site,
right?
No, we didn't. Oh. No, you couldn't. It was a whole house renovation. So that's the other thing they're often not aware of. It's like, are you really not going to hole up in the, you know, in the basement or in like a side bedroom? Unless your house is designed such that, you know, your side bedroom is very, very removed, you know, and you can do your kitchen work. I mean, really, I did have a client who stayed in their house for much of the time for a major renovation. That was in a house that is a ranch style house, very long. Oh, that's the one, Dawn, where you did. You went to the
up in
opening. Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
So that one was in Wenham, Mass. And that homeowner did stay. They did occupy the very last room,
they did.
Which was a bedroom, for a period of time. Not the whole time, but for a period of time. And boy, did they were incredibly patient. You know, that is not something.
The noise, the dust.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Boy, you have a whole set of parameters that I just don't.
Yeah.
I'm always in awe of what you have to go through to get your work done.
Well, what
an architect.
And what a homeowner. I mean, they had to endure that. So they had a period of time where they did decide, oh, we're going to go. Like they had another place they could go. But they couldn't be at that other place all the time. So that's why they did end up in this end bedroom. So I do generally recommend, oh God, you know, do not stay in the house. Like, don't even think about it.
All possible.
Yeah. So that project we were talking about in Riverside, he was not there that whole time. So
well,
he is now, you know, we always refer to his house at the site. Okay. I'll see you at the site. I'm sure he's like, okay, the site is
forever
my house.
Yes. Site.
Like that's no longer how we're going to refer to this.
Well, I just want to say, you mentioned something a few minutes ago. You give them a proposal, right?
Yes.
Obviously, you have to do that. There's so much involved in the project that you take on.
Yes.
I only started really giving proposals, or what I call quotes, in the last few years.
Okay.
I never did that in when I was in New York, because it was just a different way of working.
Right.
But it's really critical. For me, and I'm sure for you too, but for me, it's really after all these years, it's very hard to pin down the amount of time it's going to take me to do a project.
Yes.
A, because every project is different. When I'm doing custom work, now I'm talking. When I'm doing custom design work for a specific client.
Yep.
I mean, a certain kind of pattern, if it's complicated and there's tons of detail, could take weeks.
Right, right.
Where another one that's a simpler thing may only take a week or 3 days.
Yeah.
So now I try to give a proposal with, before I start the project, with sort of a gamut of what it's going to run from this amount to this amount, depending on complexity of design, the labor, the time, and any revisions.
Mm-hmm.
Like with me, it's about the artwork. It's that piece of artwork that I'm selling, that I'm charging for. It's tricky, but it's one piece of artwork. It's not a house with lots and lots of
right, but I imagine there are times, Dawn, where maybe you've underestimated. Have you found that?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, of course. And you know, me being, you know, type A, it doesn't matter if I've given them a quote for a certain amount, you know, if it takes me 8 more hours to do it,
so good.
I have to get it done and I have to look.
And you have to be proud of it.
I have to be proud of it and I have to make sure they love it. Yeah. And it's crazy business.
Now, do you find, now we talked a little bit, you know, about the themes of these collections and how you're thinking of simplifying, representing the fauna in this case. What about, I guess to me, what fascinates me in particular about what you do is the pattern making. Like, do you...
How it becomes a pattern.
Yeah, like, well, how do you think about it? Like, how do you decide
That's
what kind
the art
of pattern?
Of repeat.
Yeah, so how does that work?
I will say that in the old days, that was such a critical part of textile design because there were factories that had certain kinds of machinery and certain ways of printing where the pattern... restrictions, like mm-hmm. it had to be 24 inches vertically, it had to be 20 inches horizontally because that's what their equipment was set up for mm-hmm. and how the fabric was printed. But today with digital printing, there really are no restrictions.
So that seems harder to me, having no restrictions.
It can be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so wide open.
Yeah.
I kind of give myself restrictions.
Okay.
I say, if this is for fashion, I'm not going to go bigger than certain scale. I'm not going to go longer than a certain vertical repeat because it makes no sense.
Right.
With a design that's for a wallpaper or fabric by the yard for upholstery, usually the scale is bigger, the repeat is bigger. Mm-hmm. But it's, when it comes to the pattern, there's an art to repeat design.
Yeah.
Because if you don't consider the flow of that pattern and how it looks seamless.
Exactly. I don't want to see your square.
You don't
want to
see seams. You don't want to. Yeah. And unfortunately, I see a lot of that these days with young designers that the designs are just kind of slammed together. And it's such an obvious repeat that it's kind of boring.
I agree.
Where if you think of the old William Morris designs, you know, they were very complex floral designs with tons of detail, but you couldn't find the repeat.
Exactly.
It was so well done.
That's what I enjoy.
Like
if I see a good pattern, I'll try to find the repeat. Like I'll look at a wallpaper.
Do?
Oh, that's what I try to do. I'm like, okay, so where's the repeat?
Yeah.
And I love it when it's hard to find. It's like, wait a minute, that
it's a puzzle.
Peak is over here, but it's not in that.
Yeah. And it's such an important thing to know because if you're designing for upholstery, there are specifics. A sofa is a certain width most. Mm-hmm. So you have to design that side repeat, the width repeat to fit across the cushions of that couch. If it's huge, every cushion's going to look different.
Right.
The pattern's going to run off
the
edge in a
weird way. And
then
what if you like put the middle cushion, you know, on the end by accident? And then, you know what I mean? Like people don't always stick with what they're, you think it's so obvious. Well, that's the middle cushion. Why would you put that on the end?
I mean, the first thing my seamstress asks me when she's sewing cushions for me is, what's the repeat?
Yep.
And I never fail to like, oh, I didn't bring that with me. I'll get it back to you because it's so important.
Yes.
But yes.
Yeah.
Creating the repeat is, I think, the fun part.
And I wonder what part of your brain you're engaging when you do that. I mean, I just...
It's very mathematical.
Because it's a puzzle. Yeah,
it's a puzzle.
Yeah.
Problem solving.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. So that...
Abstract reasoning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason a lot of people find maps interesting. Because when you look, you know, a map is, you know, essentially an aerial view, if you will. And if you break a map into like a small section, like you're only going to look at one area, you can look at, let's say it's a map that shows contours. The way they weave around the contours could start to look like a pattern.
Absolutely.
And I've always just been really engaged with that. Now, to maps in general, I am one of these people who doesn't have a good sense of direction. I don't know.
Oh,
I don't
that
know
makes
about
two
you.
Of us.
But, oh, really?
Seriously,
that's what I wonder.
That's why I love New York because it's a grid.
Yes.
I could never get lost.
That's so interesting. Because
put me in Boston, forget it.
I wondered if there was a part of the brain as a pattern maker, if that meant that you had a good sense of direction. But
not so much.
Isn't that fascinating?
So weird.
Yeah. Well, there was just a piece. I'm going to plug someone else's podcast right now. I was listening to Think. Do you listen to that?
No, I never have.
Well, here we go. I'm doing a little plug now for the Rhode Island Public Radio has a segment called Think. I don't know where it's created. Anyway, they had someone on the other day talking about a book. It was a neuroscientist, I believe, had written a book about people who have a poor sense of navigation and like what's going on in your brain.
What is
going on? There's a part of your brain that's responsible for mapping. And you know, kind of that's where you figure out where you are. And so like the first time you're in a neighborhood and you walk around a neighborhood, let's say. So your brain starting to kind of record, if you will, like significant
landmarks,
yeah, features relative to you. So you create in your brain a little mental map of that neighborhood. But you can't do that unless you've walked around the neighborhood and kind of engaged right. with it. So they were right. talking about like people who get places using their cell phone directions only.
They're losing that skill.
They're losing that skill to like know where they are. And I'm one of these people who I love that the phone can get me.
Can find you
wherever I need
to go. Yeah.
But like if you ever go somewhere where then the signal dies and suddenly you're like, okay, wait a minute, like my map app isn't working. So my husband says that, and he's right. You know, did you really need to, in advance of any kind of excursion, you know, look at a map. So at least
map
you can visualize it once, yeah. you know, so you're going to see, oh, I see, I'm going north and then I'm whatever, you know.
Yeah,
so
I got to do that. See, I do that.
Me too.
Because I know, I just
exactly.
don't have a great
and
sense.
So once I, if I do that in advance, yeah, everything goes better if I do that in advance.
Okay.
But you're creating a mental map. And so I was wondering about this pattern making thing. Like, yeah, what part of the brain is allowing? Because I'm sure not everyone is nearly as astute at pattern making, even people who are trained in pattern making. You know what I mean?
There's
got to be something going on.
Well, let me tell you something. When I first started studying textile design at UMass in the textile department there, I could not wrap my head around how to create a repeat.
Okay.
Fine. If it was just a simple square, you
right.
just plugged it, you know, this pumpkin
yes.
here, like in
yes.
four corners. Okay. But when you're trying to create what's called a half drop or a brick drop, it's so that you can create flow and
right.
it's a less obvious repeat
yes.
line. I don't know why. I was like 18, 19. I'm like,
right.
I can't do this. And then it clicked one day.
It clicked.
I'm like, oh,
now what do you think
happened? That's
how
they match up, and
yeah.
that's how you shift it. And
it clicked while you were in school. When you say it clicked
yes,
one day,
yes,
what
it did.
What do you think? Is it just because you had exposure to it? Like, why did it?
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I'd never created pattern before I started
right.
studying textile design.
Right.
But now I can do it with my eyes closed.
See, that's so fascinating.
It's such
it's a way of thinking.
Such a skill, a way of thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so neat.
So anyway, this is the funnest part of what we do, I think, is the beginning stage, the concept stage, really where you get to do research and
yes.
for me,
yes.
and sketch things out. And like, you know, that's the creative design of part of what we do.
Right. Right.
That's the fun for me.
It is. So that's, I mean, and that's often what I tell, you know, homeowners, clients, that this beginning part, don't shortchange it. Like, take the time to explore, do these different iterations, and consider, you know, oh, we thought that we wanted, you know, the porch to only be on this one side, but we're realizing now that there's better light, or wouldn't it be great to look at that huge boulder or whatever? Like, to just think about a different way of letting yourself consider possibility.
And that's why they need you.
Most people
cannot do that.
Well, I'm kind of plugging, you know, the type of clients I like to work with, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, in my ideal world, you know, and I've been very fortunate in that I have had these clients who do want to kind of explore what's possible and not close down the thinking too early, you know, because it really... This is when you want to invest your energy and time, is in the beginning.
You got it.
Because once in architecture, once you kind of lock in, for lack of a better word, to an approach, to a schematic design, then everything following that point is all about executing, realizing that design and trying to make it real. And that you start from that accepted schematic, and then that's 30% of the design project. And then the next 70% of the time is trying to make it real.
It's the mechanics.
It's just figuring it all out. Yeah. Well, the supplies. Building is only the last 40%, but in terms of design, you really, 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 it's just not smart really to shut down too soon, because then you're spending all this time executing something that could have been better. If you had taken just a little more time, been a little more curious, a little bit more interested in exploring the possibilities.
Yeah, that takes a certain kind of client. You're right. I mean, I've seen enough of your work to know that you've had clients that have listened to you.
Well, yes, those are, of course, the ones.
The execution. Yes,
I'll often say, when I'm frustrated, why won't they listen to me? But yes, so
excuse me.
You do. You know, it's a collaboration. You know, like definitely there are times when I'm like, oh, let's do this or that, and then they'll say, well, I think I'd rather enter the room from over here. Uh-huh. And it's like, oh, well, that does make sense. It is better to enter the room from over there. So, you know, it's a back and forth.
Yeah.
And some clients are just really, I think they have kind of a natural affinity for design. They're interested in design.
If you're lucky.
And they've, yeah, if you're lucky, yeah. these good ones, yeah. right? And so then, and they enjoy it. That's the other thing.
They enjoy it.
This should not be painful, right? This should be something they enjoy. And so a client who is not enjoying it, that's so wrong on so many levels. You know,
because that's a tough project.
Yeah, because if you're doing
a
project like this, why would you be doing it if you're not enjoying it? You know what I mean? It's kind of like
this is
a luxury, if you will, to be able to consider your design. Yeah. And so, you know, have fun with it, right? Like So I'm trying to think what we will put on the website to illustrate this. We'll have to come up with some visuals
of
some
concepts. I definitely
concepts.
Have some visuals I can send.
And you know, process within this concept. I mean, the only thing I've said this before, I'll say it again. It, you know, for us in the architecture world, it's iterative. So there's many versions. You're not going to solve your design problem the best it can be solved at the first stab. It does take, I learn about their project, the homeowner's project, and they learn more about what it is they really want to do by going back and forth.
Yes. That's time consuming.
It is time consuming.
Necessary.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
So.
Well, that was fun. Yeah. I'll definitely send you some images of repeat pattern and how things come together. I've got some really great.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it before, but I'm still just curious to understand it a little better. And I'm sure our listeners would be interested. And as always, we always recommend that our listeners go to designmeahouse.com.
Yes. And we welcome you referring us to other friends and family, sending comments if you liked the show, or even if you didn't, leave some comments on the website. We're always interested to hear what your points of view
are. If you could go to like Apple Podcasts or one of the bigger venues and send us a little, you know, write us a little review or give us a review, you know, hopefully a lovely one, that would be helpful because we're looking to expand our audience and see if we can find more people who would be interested in talking about designing me a house.
Yeah, and maybe even having a guest if you're one of those.
Well, we're always looking for guests. And listeners may have noticed we've been having a lot more guests on, which I think is great. And I think our next segment is going to be a guest segment. And we are always looking for, you know, interesting guests, interesting topics
in the design world.
To explore in the design world. So I think it's a wrap.
That's it.
Okay.
I think it is a wrap. Thank you so much,
Katie.
All right.
Thanks, Dawn.